This is a production of Cornell University.
Prior to that, I was active duty Navy and posted in various places all over the world. I got to tell you, I even like Ithaca in the wintertime. It's great. I love being here. It's a beautiful part of the country. I've been to a lot of parts of the country and the world, and I really, really like it here. So I feel fortunate to be here at Cornell. I feel fortunate to be part of the Cornell team and the FCS team, and we've got a lot of good stuff going on. So I want to share a little bit of some of that good stuff that we got going on so you understand the context of what we're doing. And then we'll speak more specifically about some things that we're up to and some stuff that Bob and Chris and is anybody else on the Sustainable Cornell Council? Yeah. Okay. So we got all sorts of cool stuff going on. All right. So next one. So this is not a new topic. I mean, we've been looking at the sustainability thing. How does the university act as a conscientious steward of its resources, mindful of its impact, locally and more broadly than that? And so people have been looking at this, with the energy conservation back in the 80s, there are some of these kind of wavetop milestones, and there are many more out there. This is really just an excerpt of sort of the history of sustainability at Cornell. If you'd like more background, and I would encourage you to go check out and see some of that for yourself and on the sustainability website, the Cornell Sustainability Office. So just a couple of these acronyms, if you're not familiar with them. LEED is Leadership in Energy and Environmental Designs. That's a certifying organization that grades your buildings. And you submit designs to them. Once it's built, they verify that you built what you designed. And it's a way of sort of certifying that you've achieved a certain level. They look at all sorts of different things. Energy performance, obviously, but what kind of carpet did you put in there? Does it have a lot of volatile organic compounds that are going to off-gas and people breathe them in? Where have you used low VOC materials, paint, et cetera? So that's one of them. And another one is here. This is the Association for Advancement of Sustainment in Higher Education. This, again, is a sort of a outside body that most higher ed institutions are part of, and they have a grading framework for sustainability much more broadly than just buildings, but all sorts of things. What your recycling program? What about how you handle food waste in your dining hall operation? Just really top to bottom in terms of university operations. And then you have different things. You can get points for this and points for that. And so this marks the first year that we got gold, and we've been getting gold since then. So pretty good. And then we really achieved something we're all proud of: top ranked Ivy in sustainability as of last year. And last fall, as I said, we stood up the Sustainable Cornell Council, and a number of you were involved in that. So good things happening on the sustainability front. Okay? All right, so back a little while ago, we made set as our goal to achieve carbon neutrality by 2050 and then accelerated that to 2035. And we didn't just kind of make this goal out in a vacuum. We actually had people come up with a plan to get there. How do you get from here to there? And the strategy behind the plan was basically this, right? First off, can you avoid doing something that causes a big carbon footprint, all right? That's the easiest energy to save is the energy you don't use, the kilowatt idea, if you've heard of that. So avoid building new space. For me and Facilities Campus Services, how do we make best use of the facilities we already have? So on this front, we are right now fielding this 25 Live program. Who's heard of that? It's a new classroom scheduling software, a handful of you. How do we make classrooms and other spaces, study rooms, seminar rooms, how do we make them visible so people can schedule them and use them? And, gasp, even across colleges, how would you, reach over there? I know this is big stuff. Breaking lots of eggs to make this omelet. But, if you have to build new space because this department or this college has run out, even though there might be capacity elsewhere. If you decide, no, we're going to build new, well, you've got to build it, you've got to heat it, you've got to cool it, you've got to maintain it, you've got to recapitalize. I mean, you bought a lot of work and therefore a lot of carbon footprint, for the life of that facility. So if you can avoid doing that in the first place, you're ahead of the game. Okay, well, we still got a job to do, and we're not going to do it, in tents or in the open air. So what do you do with what you've already got? Well, you figure out ways to reduce, all right?
We have a very aggressive energy conservation program here on campus. Some of it is aimed at the people on campus, so user behavior. We do an energy smackdown every year that's really aimed at the students. We've got green office certifications and green team certifications for folks in the different units on the staff and faculty side. So we have some of this is oriented at user behavior. We also have a very robust energy conservation initiative program. We have reinvested something on the order of $30 million back into energy improvements over the last 10 years. Okay? And all of those, they have to have a demonstrated payback before we'll put the money in. But once we pencil it out, and if it looks good, we'll put the money in and do it. Some of you may have seen the LED replacement streetlights that we put in. We finished it up last fall. It's been rolling out for a while, but they basically finished it last fall. So that was one of these efforts here. We've done some laboratories. We're doing more laboratories, energy recovery systems. Laboratory ventilation is very important from a personal safety point of view, so people are not exposed to toxins. But if you take all the air that you just conditioned and pump it right outside, you know, that's a lot of wasted energy. So this is a way to recover the energy. As the exhaust air goes out, it either heats or cools the incoming makeup air, right? So you don't just dump all that to the atmosphere. So there are ways to reduce on what you've got already. So when you brought that down, you're still getting your job done, but you brought that down, and now you say, all right, how do we move this that's currently fueled by fossil fuels, either for electricity or heat, and how do we move that to a renewable source, all right? And we've got some of that already in the works. And then finally, you're left with some residual that you kind of can't get around, right? So if we are a university, a research university with international stature, people are going to travel, right? So rather than put them back on sailboats or whatever, if they fly, you know, you have to think about what's the carbon footprint of that air travel, and how can we offset that with, you know, something that's legit that passes muster to offset that. Okay, so that's the basic strategy of what we're doing, and then some of you may have heard about the quadruple bottom line. So we don't just decide, hey, what's going to cost us the least amount of money, and then that's what we go with. We don't just say, hey, you know, how do we get to carbon neutral as quick as we can and damn the expense. We are applying a quadruple bottom line. So we're looking at what is our impact on the planet. That's bottom line number one. What is impact on people, all right, both, you know, our on-campus community and then, you know, on out from there. What is the impact on prosperity, so there is the financial aspect. And lastly, what about purpose? What about our academic mission? Those are the four bottom lines. So ideally, we consider all of those, and you know, it may be hard to get a win in every one of those columns, but we want to make sure that we are optimizing among those four. All right, it makes it a little harder, but I think it ultimately makes it better. Okay. All right, so here is a cool animated slide that you don't get to see. So right here, let me just say this. This is where we start. This is our baseline year. 260,000 metric tons of CO2 equivalents. That was our carbon footprint. Now, already we've reduced that 35%. It's 36 and some change. Okay, so we've made huge progress already. But there's our goal, right? It's to get to zero. What does that actually consist of? The donut is what the remaining emissions, the 165,000, you took that as the whole. How are we going to get after that? How are we going to reduce that? For the purposes of discussion, I've left the transportation piece out. That is a component that we track. We have less direct control over that, but we are pursuing it. Okay, so I don't want to create the impression that we're not addressing transportation. It's just a little trickier to get after, and we have, you know, more direct control about what we do on campus. So that's what I'm briefing about. So to get that remaining 165 down to zero, we got to do several things. High performance buildings. Okay, this is those high performing LEED type buildings that really don't use a lot of energy and still get the job done. Part of it is converting our energy distribution system. I'll speak a little bit more to that in a second. From steam to hot water. Part of it is getting to a renewable heat supply, okay? So we have our central heating plant provides electricity and steam to the campus. It's fueled by gas. All right, so how can we move the source over to something renewable? And then how do we get all this electricity, you know, which is mostly provided by our plant, moved over to a renewable source? So let's hit each one of these. All right, so the renewables. Actually, we have made huge progress already. 20% of our electricity needs are already provided through renewable sources. You know, we have a hydro plant down here on Fall Creek. It's been there for 115 years. Okay, it's a little over a megawatt, which used to be a lot compared to needs. It powered the campus and actually powered much of the electricity required by the city of Ithaca. Okay? Obviously, everybody needs more now, so it doesn't cover all that, but it's still part of our campus load. So that's already covering that much. And we have now entered into a large-scale renewable energy consortium. There are a number of other schools in New York, public and private, that we have joined together and pooling our buying power. And we've basically we've just hired an energy consultant whose job it is to go out and find renewable energy deals that will be power purchase agreements for the consortium to tap into. Okay, so the idea is that we should be able to tap into some large-scale things and bigger scale than what we were doing ourselves. And this is the one that just opened in Dryden, 18-megawatt community solar. So by leveraging that buying power in the context of that consortium, we are envisioning getting to 100% renewable electricity. Time frame is a little TBD because we're dependent on the market to bring that to us, so I can't tell you, you know, by X date just yet. So we'll see what they come up with. They've got the consultant online, and we expect them to be bringing us proposals within weeks and reducing that carbon footprint accordingly. Next one. All right, another great build slide that got ruined, but let's talk about high performance buildings. So
I can load
we've got
up
a
your
couple buildings here.
Do you load up your deck?
Have you got it there?
Yeah.
Fantastic. All right, I'll keep talking. Just to illustrate what I mean, like a high-performance building, what does that even mean? A couple of recent buildings. The one on the left is Upson Hall, and Upson was a gut renovation. It's an engineering building, finished up in 2017. And the one on the right in that picture, if you don't recognize it, that's the Bloomberg Building at Cornell Tech on Roosevelt Drive. Okay? And I'll just highlight a few of the features. Oh, there we go. Look at that. Beautiful. Keep going. Yeah, one more. Okay. All right. First one. A very robust building envelope. Very well insulated walls and roof. Okay. So you're not losing your energy through the building envelope to the environment. Next one. Oop. Yeah. There we go. So the window to wall ratio. Fairly modest. Okay. So it's not a lot of glass. Glass is a very poor insulator. Right? So you want enough glass so people are not feeling like they're in a basement, right? So sunshine is good for us, but it's bad for your energy performance. So you got to balance that out. So that's kept in check. We got LED lights all throughout the building with controls. So occupancy sensors in the room. So if nobody's there, boom, light goes out. Wish I had more of those at home with my teenagers. All right, next one. Energy recovery, spoke to this a little bit already. And you're not just exhausting all that nice warm air to the atmosphere in January. You recover the heat. Next one. We've got provisions for bikeability, walkability, access to mass transit, so that you know, people can get to and from. Keep going. For Bloomberg Building, rooftop PV solar PV. And then next one. This is pointing to the geothermal well field. So they are using a heat pump system there, and have got a well field of some 40 wells that are drilled in this is the over top is the pedestrian plaza. Okay, on to the next one. All right, so that's at the building level. Let's talk about how the heat gets to the building. That's your distribution system. Okay, right now, as I said, it's a steam distribution system. I mean, steam was the way to go back in the day. Now, with other ways of generating heat, really the way to go is hot water. And you lose, it's more efficient, you're losing less to the environment through your pipes, but the trick is that you have to size everything in the building to take hot water instead of steam. Steam comes in pretty hot. 325 degrees Fahrenheit is our design standard. Okay? The hot water is going to come in at about 180, so much less. You've got an engineering problem to figure out how to size everything. That's not very hard, really. I mean, for a decent engineer, they can figure that out. The harder part is, how do you transform your system while still running the system and while optimizing, you know, for some constraints? You don't, again, quadruple bottom line, we want to do it in a cost-effective way, and so we got to figure this thing out. So we got, thankfully, about $500,000 of NYSERDA grant money to help us figure this out, and so we'll be working on this in the next coming years. The money is just showing up now. We're hiring the consultants, so we'll be working on this in a couple of years. Starting now, but I think it'll take us a couple of years. Okay? All right, and so we've got the building point, we've got the distribution. Well, what's your source? The options group that looked at what are our various possibilities, they reported out a couple years ago, 2016. They recommended that EarthSource E be our primary choice for a couple of reasons. One is it's really innovative, it has the potential to scale beyond Cornell, and it's very efficient. This is analogous to lake source cooling. So whereas lake source cooling, we have the lake, we draw cold water out of the lake, run it through a heat exchanger, and then a secondary loop carries that nice cool water through the campus to cool off the buildings. This would be a similar idea. We've got, in this case, water going down deep into the earth. It circulates through porous zones in the rock, picks up heat, and you draw it up, run it through a heat exchanger, and you distribute it out to campus to heat the building. So, you know, cold water from the lake, warm water from the earth. That's the concept. So you have a well pair. Now, this is not trivial. We're talking about going down like 3 miles deep. It's deep, okay? But it's groundbreaking, innovative research, which, you know, that's what Cornell's about, and it'd be pretty cool if it worked. So that's EarthSource Heat. We got a grant of just over $1 million from DOE, which we have been working through for the last 2 years. That basically enabled us to do a lot of above-ground research. We've gone back through all the drilling logs we could find in the area. We've got folks in earth and atmospheric science who have done additional research based on that. We've gotten seismic data. There was some exploration done before New York decided not to proceed with fracking. There was some active seismic mapping done with those bumper trucks, they call them. A vibroseismic truck is the actual technical term. So it's like like the in-ground equivalent of radar. You send a signal out, and then you measure and look at the returns from that signal. And you can actually figure out the geology, the structures that are in the ground based on that signal. So we've got some data back from that we've analyzed, and then we've actually installed a passive seismic array to start getting a baseline for what seismic activity is here in the area. So we've done just about all that you can do above ground. The next real step for us to advance this is to get a, whoops, is that me or you?
That was me.
Okay, back. So is to get a well in the ground and really see what's down there. So you can, what we need to find is the right zone, back. We need to find the right zone of permeability in the rock and temperature. Can you back one more?
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah, there you go. All right, so the trick is you've got to find a zone that has sufficient temperature and sufficient permeability so the water will flow. That's the idea. The good news is that if we can get down there, we can get some decent flow. Even if we don't get all the temperature rise that we're looking for, that we can look at a hybrid type system and augment with industrial size heat pumps. If that temperature increase is not enough to get to the design set point, we sent a couple of engineers over to France last year. And there's a company called Engie that is has fielded a system like this in the Paris Basin. So they use warm water, it's not hot enough, and then they bump it up, carrier heat pumps, how about that? So bump that up to the design set point to actually circulate it through. So if you can get the flow, it's not an all or nothing proposition. You can then augment that. So that's encouraging. Okay, now on to the next one. So here is our vision of the future. You have high-performance buildings. You can't see the distribution system except for this little leg, but you've got a hot water distribution system instead of steam. You've got renewables providing electricity, so whether that's PV, whether that's wind, whether that's water. You've got the lake providing cooling, and the earth providing So that's our vision in the future, and it's a pretty cool vision. So we're getting after it. All right. Let's talk about what we came up with on the Sustainable Cornell Council. So when I got here 2.5 years ago, we had kind of two different sustainability organizations. We had the Senior Leader Climate Action Group, the SLAG. We had the President Sustainable Cornell Council, the PSCC. It wasn't clear to me what the rules or roles or the differentiation between the two was. And I wasn't the only one that was not clear on what these two groups were supposed to do. There's a lot of overlap and a lack of definition between the two. So we pulled back a little bit and said, all right, look, let's get this thing square. So we have a clear vision, we can articulate it to people, we can explain what we're doing, and roll this thing out again. And so that's what we did. And the result was the Sustainable Cornell Council, which was rolled out last fall. I'm sure you guys all saw it. Okay, next one. So what does that actually look like? It looks like this. We have a leadership team, report to the provost right here. We came up with three committees, all right, looking at various aspects of what does it take kind of to get us there, all right? The biggest lift on the carbon neutrality side is the Carbon Neutral Campus Committee. And Bob is on that one. That one is chaired by Lance Collins, who's the Dean of Engineering, and Bert Bland, who's the AVP for Energy and Sustainability. And Bob and Lindsay Anderson and who else is on there? Natalie Mahal. Natalie, okay. And then, and we'll talk a minute about some of these working groups. I'll get to that one on the next slide. So these folks are really like, how do you get that donut down to zero? That's the work of this group. All right, campus operations. Pat Wynn, UNSCL, some of you know her. She and I are heading this one up. Chris is on our team. Got anybody else? Nobody else is in this group from that team. But our job is looking at what about the rest of the campus business? You know, we are running a small city, basically, here on campus. How do we do that in a sustainable manner? And there are all sorts of different things. So we'll talk about what we intend to take on with that one. And then the third one here is, hey, you know what? We're a university. What are we doing about educating our students? What are we doing about engaging with the community here locally, as well as, you know, on out to the global scale, all right? And that one's being headed up by two of the vice provosts, Catherine McComas for Land Grant Affairs and Engagement, and Lisa Nishi, who's undergrad education. So,
Rick, if I could just interject, Caroline will need, but the provost invited us to appoint one person from the UAC, so Caroline, we're sitting there.
You're on the EME, right? Yeah, okay, great. All right, well, I'm going to ask you guys to speak to yours on the next slide, which we're going to next. All right, so this is what those committees came up with in terms of what they're going to take on for the near term. So take them on, work them, and then hopefully get them to some conclusion. You guys can declare victory, and maybe you'll be done. I'll never be done because we'll always have something to get after, right? Bob, would you mind, or you want to speak to any of these? I can speak to them if you don't.
I think they're fairly clear. One of the challenges is we do travel a lot, we commute a lot. There have been proposals going around for several years to have some sort of fee travel offset. There are all sorts of issues associated with that. Mm-hmm. Flag for a proposal for the setup, but the group has a subgroup working on that. They're just getting started, so not much to say.
Yep.
The next one is make it by electricity, and that's because though we're producing more of our electricity renewably, we also produce a lot of electricity from our gas generators for heat, including in the summer when we're not necessarily needing the heat. So there's a question of whether that's really the best thing to do if we're trying to reduce our greenhouse gas emissions. And there's a group working on that. I'm a member of that. And then the numbers that Rick showed for the reduction in greenhouse gas emissions, that's really just for carbon dioxide. Methane emissions have gone up, but there's a debate about how we handle those. So SCLAG suggested one way, the state now has new legislation suggesting a slight modification of that, and we have a subgroup to talk about how to consider that.
Yep. Okay. So that's what that group is going to take on. The education and engagement. Carolyn, you want to talk at all about this one?
Sure. I mean, we talked a lot about what happens when people enter our community and how we can talk about Cornell's commitments to climate, to thinking about climate, to understanding climate. And so we started with students. That's the easiest group to reach on their arrival. So that's the first task. Then we have a member of our committee who does research into why even when people really understand climate change, they still don't act on it. And that's because choice architecture, that is organizing the experience rather than necessarily telling people what to do and then expecting them to do it, is more effective, in fact, in changing decisions. So that's the behavior change piece. And then the Living Lab is a really exciting sort of co-curricular where you think about how to both study, understand, and live climate solutions on the campus. So.
Okay, thanks. And then this campus operations team, which is the one that I'm on, we're looking at transportation. So I spoke to that just briefly. How do we reduce that transportation footprint? Our transportation demand management plan is going to be the primary tool that we do have a transportation demand management plan. It's out of date, so that needs to be revisited. There's been a resolution advanced by Chris of, hey, how do we get a campus circulator so that we're able to get around and employ the parking that we have. You know, we're a little bit challenged. Overall, we have enough spaces, but they're not really where we'd like to have them. Ideally, some of the ones where there's space are at the periphery. And so if you want people to walk more or take the bus more, you got to have a decent transportation solution, which involves getting to campus and then getting around campus. All right, so we're going to be looking at that. Materials management. This is mostly in my organization. One of our directors, who's in charge of purchasing, told me that we have to either stock or order something on the order of 60 or 70 different types of light bulbs to keep the campus lit. Right, that's basically impossible. You can't stock that many different light bulbs. So if somebody, you know, the light burns out, you end up ordering. So that complexity of stuff and trying to keep up with it all is a lot of extra effort, really, to just, you know, deliver light. And you can multiply that across a bunch of different systems on campus. So we are taking a look at where we can reduce by making better decisions on what we decide to specify, right? Because we decided what kind of lights are going to go in there. We wrote the spec, or we accepted the architect's spec for the lights that went in this building and others. So can we narrow that universe just a little bit so it's easier to keep up on? Less effort, less wasted and stranded inventory, less stuff thrown out because you don't need it anymore, easier to get the job done, and more effective getting the job. That's what we're after. So that one's going to be a good one. Actually, so for really, that's going to be prioritizing what we work on first. You've got so many opportunities. And then the last one is in dining and SEL, looking at our food waste. Right? We've got a large dining operation across the campus. You know, if you can save food from being thrown out, think of all the upstream savings there. You know, you didn't have to cook it. You didn't have to chop it up and prep it. You didn't have to, you know, ship it. You didn't have to, you know, it was grown. We didn't have to grow it and waste it. Somebody else gets the benefit of that instead of ending up in the compost pot, right? So if we can figure out how to save there, upstream effects multiply. So those are the three that we're going to be working on in the campus operations. Next one. Okay, this last one. So recognizing that these committees, there are only so many people and they can't take on everything, we wanted to leave room deliberately for what we call partner initiatives. So there are other things going on out on campus. For instance, the Earth Source Heat team has been up and running since before this SCC thing on. So the Earth Source Heat team is going to keep on going. They're not going to reorganize. They're going to keep doing what they're doing, and they're going to have periodic updates to the Carbon Neutral Campus Committee to say, hey, here's how we're doing, this is what we got, this is the latest, okay? And we actually came by, I was part of the briefing, and we briefed Bob and the rest of the committee on where we were on Earth Source Heat. It was about September-ish, early October, to do that. So we've got renewable inside the sustainability office, we've got efforts on renewable electricity that will continue, steam to hot water conversion, I've got engineers working on that, just all these things that are happening. They don't stop happening, and they'll just, we want to fill in so that it's communicated and coordinated, and the committee that they fall under is staying up to date. Same thing with campus operations. A lot of stuff going on outside of just what the team has taken on, and we want to stay in tune or keep them up to date on that. And I think that's the last one. Oh, no, it's not the last one. So same thing on education engagement. So a number of initiatives that are happening already, and then we want to make sure that they're linked in. You want to comment on this? I'm not familiar with these so much. Okay. Great. So that's what we got going on, and I hope you can see there's a lot of good stuff happening. Questions, comments, feedback.
Thank you, Rick. I'd like to practice my question by thanking you for being here and taking the time. I know you have busy schedules. In your presentation, you discussed the quadruple bottom line that is used to evaluate actions, and one of which the pillars are the people themselves. In addition, you discussed prioritizing community engagement. So in recent years, climate justice movements have advocated for the inclusion of Native American and Indigenous groups when setting goals and finding solutions for climate change. Not only do we inhibit Indigenous people's lands, but these groups have invaluable knowledge and understanding of the complexities of our environment. So I was wondering if Cornell or the Sustainable Cornell Council is working closely with the Cayuga Nation or the Haudenosaunee Confederacy on environmental issues that they pertain to the university, and if not, why?
I don't know of any specific outreach on the energy, in the energy area or carbon reduction area to the Cayuga Nation. I would welcome some suggestions about how to do that in a practical way. As I say, I'm not aware of any specific interaction.
Thank you. Other questions, comments?
I got two things that I didn't hear you mention. From the Sustainability Leadership Summit, which happened on December 17th of last year, which is recorded online, so if you go and search that, you can see the variety of us walking and talking sustainability. But it was an interesting stat to know that of 15,000 undergrads enrolled at Cornell, 9,500 of them are in a sustainability-related course. And that is actually, it could be a little bit higher, but it depends on how cross-enrollment and those things. So it is obvious that it is very important to students incoming in the undergraduate class is sustainability as part of the future and their future. And then it was hot news at the time about North Campus expansions, going out to bid for rooftop solar.
Yes.
Is that a... We signed it. It's before I commit something, can
right.
you explain that part of
yes.
it?
Yes. We are going to put the new North Campus buildings that are coming online will have rooftop solar, and that's going to offset something like 35% of the electrical use of those new facilities. So that was a big step, and it'll be structured basically as a power purchase agreement, so we won't have to buy all the stuff, but we signed a contract with it. A solar provider that will do that. So that was a big move forward. Yeah, and that day was on the EDP's desk and she signed off on it. So that was a big asset. Thank you.
Other questions, comments,
So if I understood this correctly, when you started evaluating for source heat, if that is viable, when would that start and then finish for actual
Well, that one, you know, is highly dependent on funding. It's an expensive proposition. We are estimating something on the order of $30 million to put in a well pair that I illustrated there. So that's the challenge, is to identify. We won't do the well pair first. We'll do it. We'll drill one. So we're probably looking for about $12 million to do the one. We have, with very extensive work done by Jason Cole and others in the government relations office, identified some real opportunities to get some funding from the federal government through DOE. They have a deep geothermal program. Very promising legislation on that side. And we're also working with the state of New York so that if we were to get some money through DOE, typically there's a match required. Could we get the match from New York State? On the other side. Jason, you want to add anything to that?
No, I think that's
that's about as much as we can say with confidence right now, because there's a lot that we don't control in that whole process. But that would be the idea. So we're a little dependent on that. Like, if I had all the money today, we still have to go through processes. I mean, you can't do some of these things without, you know, looking at the environmental impact and talking to the community. And, you know, there's a process to step through that. So I don't want to hazard a timeline, you know, just yet.
Yeah, I just want to add that there's a sequence to this. I mean, first is really feasibility. As Rick has laid out, we have to understand the thermal profile as we drill, so we'll learn a lot from the first test wells. My sense is if those initial experiments are successful or produce optimism around this, that leads, and we've had these discussions about investment of other sources to be able to exploit what is a carbon neutral heat source for the Northeast of enormous impact for this region.
So then just to follow up on that, if the Earth's source heat isn't viable, is the 2035 plan still in motion to make that deadline?
Yeah, so a couple things to observe there. First off, you know, we've got to have the whole system, right? So we've got to have a source, we've got to have distribution, and we've got to have the facilities end of it. And we're working on each of those in parallel. If you get the distribution system set up to work off hot water, then the source of that hot water could be Earth source heat, it could be large-scale heat pumps, it could be, you know, something fueled by biofuel or some other means. You could have solar heat. I mean, there are different sources for that heat. We've chosen Earth source heat as the primary, you know, one we want to get after. If we were to, like, we successfully prove it can't work here, you don't even get flow, okay, and it's just a complete bust, well, then you have to go to another source. And, you know, by then, Bob will have figured out how to green the New York grid, and we can run large-scale pumps as the heat source. That can still work, and that can still get us there. But if you can get the flow, as I said, if you can get flow and you can get a bump in the temperature, so maybe it doesn't get all the way up to what you want, but you get something that's still worthwhile, then we'd have some calculating to do to figure out, do you do a hybrid system where you're still doing the Earth source piece and augmenting it, or do you say, the heck with the Earth source part, let's just go to a heat pump-based solution. And then you'd have to figure out, is it one big one, do you go with nodes, it would be a little bit of systems analysis to figure out how to get there. The heat pump thing is doable. If you did it right now today, the grid power or our power here is not all green. But that's just a straight up expense. We just have to go and buy those things. And that's a big chunk of money. If we can do what the provost is saying, where, you know, we would prove it out here and then have some ability to license the technology, and then we've got, you know, money coming to us to offset that expense, that would really be added. So that's some of the stuff we got to figure out.
One other point, and it gets to the timeline here, because you know, what we're talking about is really an approach to the entire community heating or district heating system that we currently have, which is currently steam distribution. So there's a lot of work to do to get all these buildings that are currently piped for steam and plumbed for steam to be able to convert to hot water. Then, during that period of time, we're going to learn a lot about Earth source heat. It's inconceivable to me that, you know, my home is heated with geothermal heat. That goes 8 feet down in a horizontal manner. It's inconceivable to me that if you drill 3 miles down, you don't get warmer. So we'll get something out of this. The key thing to me is, we have to continue to do this in an efficient way in which we think about the district system, so the entire system. We don't start building buildings where we're putting heat pumps at every building, and every building is a separate, inefficient system. I think that's important, and there's been a lot of thinking about how to do that in a systematic way. Let me just say one thing to Bob about, again, where we've had a little bit of disagreement and friction is around the issues that Bob has raised around our our use our burning of natural gas, the methane impact of that, and the fact that we're currently in a very efficient way generating electricity with that natural gas instead of buying it off the grid, which, you know, has some carbon cost from the grid as well. We can argue about how much carbon cost is on the grid versus how much we're costing the planet from our burning natural gas. I think that's a great question. It's a question that experts should look at and come to some consensus about, and then make a recommendation to us about what's the best thing to do. The transfer to grid in the summer and increase our grid consumption of electricity from the summer in the near term while we're moving towards renewable greater renewable capacity, or continue to run our steam generator or cogen plant during that period.
And that's one of the topics that we have a subcommittee working on. It's been meeting, isn't it, twice, and we're meeting every second week between now and April until we reach some sort of consensus, which I think we will. And we're looking at the sort of short term, what to recommend to you, the
right,
university, for
right,
the next year or two. But we're also keeping in mind that under the new state law, if it actually enforced, we're supposed to have a 100% renewable grid in New York by 2040.
Chris, I can fill in a couple of extra blanks. So Renato, what you're talking about, and this is all my notes from the Leadership Summit, the 2035 plan goals is that in 2035, 11% of our energy and carbon footprint will be from high-performance buildings, 9% from steam to hot water distribution, 37% is from the renewable heat supply, and Earth source heat is Plan A for that. So in 2035, you know, that's a pretty big chunk. 9% is supplementary peak heat, where we would have potentially biofuel or thermal storage, 3% on-site renewable, which is like a rooftop solar, and then 31% off-site renewable electricity, where, you know, if we buy from the grid from somebody, you know, wind farms or whatever. In January, right now, there should be an international workshop on test well research, so people all over the world looking at how are we going to really do this well. Theoretically, we would potentially be roll-ready by the coming summer with all the permits and site selection. Rick presented at the Campus Planning Committee three different sites that could potentially be where this is going to happen. But that also, as Rick and Provost Kotloff mentioned, there's a lot of ongoing discussions with the town and county officials. There's going to be another community town hall, and then fundraising has to be done, as well as partnering with the DOE and the state. But this has been a really good year for New York State to really lay down the rules of the future. And not only are we joining the club, we're leading the club as far as like New York State facing this.
Just to emphasize, so we don't lose that point, that point that Chris made, 31% of our carbon footprint, of our current carbon footprint, we could eliminate by this consortium that essentially buys renewable electricity, not buying from the grid. So a long-term contract where we will receive our electricity from those sources, that is huge. So we're not waiting, you know, that's a big chunk of our carbon that could happen soon.
And not in a way where we don't have to pony up a large chunk of Cornell money for the capital, right? So we just buy the electricity and our power purchase agreement. So that's advantageous in terms of our finances.
I think we'll probably end there.
Thanks for the opportunity. Lots of good stuff going on. I appreciate your support. Thanks all.
This is you.
I postponed at the very beginning the call for any lead additions to the agenda. Hearing none, I would ask you to approve the minutes.
I motion to approve the minutes.
For a second?
Second.
Any discussion? Opposed? Abstained? Minutes are approved unanimously. Thank you. Our next agenda item is a resolution on divestment. Adam, how will we present together with Caroline Levine?
The only thing I'll mention at the outset is that the resolution and the white papers, the excellent work of Caroline. Carolyn. I personally just want to thank her, and I'm excited to be a co-sponsor of the resolution. But I will. If we're ready, just turn it over for her presentation. It sounded like they thought the argument was something as well.
Yes, they seem to focus more on the prose style, but you know, what can we do? Take our points where we can. So what I have is an 8-minute presentation, which just highlights some of the points that are made in the white paper that was circulated as background. The white paper is getting longer and more complicated each round. So if you happen to look at it in November, December, it's better now, but a little longer. So I will provide a short summary at some point soon. So why divestment? We've now reached a point where 11,000 scientists are calling the moment that we're in a climate emergency. The reason it's an emergency is that we're getting close to tipping points for extreme and irreversible warming, with consequences that are already underway, like mass species extinction, uninhabitable temperatures, rising oceans, and ongoing droughts and wildfires, all of which are going to prompt human migration and starvation on very large scales. So unless we make major changes quickly, we're likely to see unprecedented suffering in the coming decades. So the Campus Infrastructure Committee took up the question of divestment and have been asking and probing and investigating whether or not this is something that we would like to ask the Board of Trustees to consider. And we have come to the conclusion that divestment is a meaningful action that Cornell can and should take as soon as possible. So, in part, this is a response to the trustees directly. When they last considered divestment from fossil fuels in 2016, they said no to divestment, but they didn't say no, no, not ever, you know, it's out of the question. Instead, they wrestled with the question of which companies might justify divestment, and they laid out a series of criteria. So here's what they said. They said divestment should be considered only when a company's actions or inactions are morally reprehensible, that is, deserving of condemnation because of the injurious impact that the actions or inactions of a company are found to have on consumers, employees, or other persons. In addition, divestment should be only considered when the divestment will likely have a meaningful impact toward correcting the specified harm and will not result in disproportionate offsetting negative societal consequences, or the company in question contributes to harm so grave that it would be inconsistent with the goals and principles of the university. So the Campus Infrastructure Committee is persuaded that fossil fuel companies meet all of these criteria. So it's A and B or C, but we think it meets A, B, and C. And so we're going to we've laid out our arguments in the white paper, but I'm going to give you just a really brief overview of how we argue that the fossil fuel companies are meeting these criteria that the trustees set forward for divestment. So the first is we found a clear case for moral reprehensibility, and that lies in the fact that fossil fuel companies knew about the connection between carbon emissions and global warming and engaged in a deliberate campaign of doubt and misinformation. So in the 1970s, Exxon's own scientists warned that fossil fuels could cause irreversible and catastrophic events, and they actually used those words in their own report. But instead of spending money on renewables and shifting away from fossil fuels, Exxon spent millions of dollars on a campaign to cast doubt on the link between fossil fuels and climate change, and they in fact used the same people who cast doubt on the link between tobacco and cancer, exactly the same kind of ad campaign. So one of the things we found is that all of the major fossil fuel companies hid what they knew, and that most are still in some way contributing to the hiding of that knowledge. So they're funding think tanks or lobbyists who occlude or hide that knowledge. We also found a case for injurious impact. In 2018, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change warned that if we're going to keep the planet from warming to uninhabitable levels, we need to reduce carbon emissions quickly worldwide. That means that just using up current fossil fuel reserves will exceed our carbon budget. But fossil fuel companies, even now, even when we know that even if we just used what we've got, are insisting on expanding production of oil and gas. And so this is a catastrophic pathway that the fossil fuel companies are insisting on. So Shell and ExxonMobil are planning to produce 35% more oil by 2030, and they're spending millions of dollars each year lobbying governments around the world for new rights to mine and drill. So in this context, it seems important to point out just how important fossil fuels are to global warming. So part of the case for injurious impact is that these particular companies are contributing the most to our current climate predicament. Fossil fuel use generates 70% of worldwide carbon dioxide equivalent emissions. Just 90 corporations are responsible for 66% of all greenhouse gas emissions. And 8 energy companies account for just 20% of for as much as 20% of world carbon emissions, and these include the big famous ones, British Petroleum, ExxonMobil, Royal Dutch Shell, and Chevron. So the question that comes up at this point is whether divestment actually makes a difference, and that's one of the things the trustees ask: can you show that it makes a material impact? I know many of you have questions about the value and impact of divesting, but we became persuaded by the case for the meaningful impact of divestment. For me, there were two big discoveries. First of all, it's clear that investments in fossil fuels have been very bad for the past decade, while fossil fuel portfolios have been outperforming them every single year. So it just looks like a bad investment. When the University of California system divested just this past year, they said that it wasn't for climate reasons, it was just that they're financially not a great investment. So, bad investments. The second reason to think about divesting in terms of having not harming the university and having a positive impact is that divestment isn't only about how much money we've invested. What we know is that businesses work to build and maintain strong reputations. And when a great university like Cornell divests and therefore sends the public message that fossil fuel companies are disreputable actors spreading lies and misinformation, this message can have a meaningful impact on the public view of these companies. And Shell actually explains that they hate divestment because it makes it harder for them to operate. So a meaningful impact in that sense. Finally, we were persuaded by the case for harm so grave that it is inconsistent with the goals and principles of the university. This feels so important to me personally. I think we have two really precious fundamental missions here at Cornell that we all work towards every single day, and both of them are at stake in the question of divestment. So, first of all, teaching. So we work every day to educate young people so that they can lead fulfilling and productive lives. But at the same time, our investments in fossil fuels are wreaking havoc with their futures, leading us down a path of global food shortages, catastrophic flooding, and violent unrest that will affect every single student here, now, and into the future. The second precious mission that we have is research. So we're pouring our talents and our energies into producing truth, that is rigorous knowledge, for the public good. But at the same time, we're investing in companies that have poured millions of dollars into attacking science, misinforming the public about the very research that we do right here at Cornell, and even smearing individual scientists like our own Bob Howarth. So as the president of Unity College says, it is ethically indefensible that an institution dedicated to the proposition of the renewal of civilization would simultaneously invest in its destruction. And I think that captures both the teaching and the research sides of the problem. So if we did divest, we wouldn't be reinventing the wheel. Cornell is world-renowned as a leader in sustainability. We would be the first Ivy to divest, and that would give us, as Adam Hell helped me to understand what economists and other business leaders called a first mover advantage. That is, if we're the first to divest, the first Ivy League university to divest, that brings us the very strong advantages of a reputation in sustainability that we're very strongly trying to maintain. And a recent survey of prospective students done by the Princeton Review showed that 66% of prospective students care about how sustainable the campuses are that they apply to and decide to attend. So this could be a very important gesture on our part. The other thing is that being the second mover is actually worse than just coming along later. So you want to be either first or not at all. It's there that we have the potential advantage. And since Cornell is so keen to emphasize our reputation in sustainability, it seems like something that we could really strongly recommend that the trustees take seriously as part of boosting Cornell's worldwide reputation. So there's lots of questions and answers that people have. I've done some looking into some of the answers to some of them that have come up in these kinds of conversations. But our resolution is very simple. It is deliberately, we put most of the research, most of the details into the white paper, partly because we want to coordinate with all of the five assemblies so that our language is the same, so it can go to the trustees as a common or shared resolution. So we've simply asked the trustees to consider divesting in an orderly fashion and as quickly as possible, rather than making very, very specific criteria. So some of the other assemblies may have more specific criteria, but we wanted to make sure that we were speaking the same language and asking for the same things. Adam and I are happy to answer any questions that you have.
Thank you for that presentation.
Sure.
Real quick, I just want to echo without being too repetitious. I think that I encourage everybody to really share this this white paper. And there are a lot of amazing points that go directly to the criteria that the board laid out for this or all the assemblies to address with regards to making the case for divestment. My personal perspective is that, you know, this is a single challenge of our time that can be seen as somewhat abstract with, in comparison to some of the things that have been mentioned by the board in the past, human trafficking, genocide, apartheid, slavery, things like that. But I would argue that the human impact of climate change over a longer curve can eclipse many of all of these horrible human conditions. There are a few statements that I just wanted to mention that were made by members of the board with regards to this effort in 2016. One of them being other avenues besides divestiture may be more effective and not merely symbolic. Again, without being too repetitious, I think that there is a very powerful argument in this white paper that lays out that this is not a merely symbolic effort, but also I wouldn't dismiss the power of symbolism in this effort, considering that where we have our money invested in the endowment is a statement of our values, and the symbolism behind the divestiture is something that can really make us a leader in the space, as we've mentioned before. Another thing that was brought up in Article 2016 was that Cornell's overriding responsibility is to maintain itself as a neutral forum for analysis, debate, and the search for truth. I think this figure is dated because it's from 2016. But 97% of climate researchers are actively publishing are in agreement that this is this is something that's happening. It's human driven. It's human driven, and it is detrimental to our future. The search for truth in our mutual position is not sacrificed by making a statement that is in line with the vast majority of peer driven research in the body of evidence that is out there. There are people, literally at this moment, who debate whether the Earth is, or say that the Earth is flat. Not lending credence to that argument does not sacrifice our neutral position or our honest broker status. I believe that this is something to where we should, in line with our principles as an institution, be a leader on. We have an opportunity here, especially considering we could be the first among CIVs. I believe that we should take that opportunity. And my, again, thank you for all the great work on this. I'm very proud to have my name on this, but you were really the driver of all this, this wonderful effort and this great resolution, and I urge passage, and of course we'll take questions.
And one slight update on your 97%. There's a new study that came out, and as of November of last year,
99.5% sounded very, very low. I actually read it, so thank you.
And one, we have the resolution. Are you formally introducing the resolution?
Yes,
today.
Yes, okay. Absolutely.
That's all. Would you like to make a motion?
Yes. Well, do we want to make a motion for open the floor for debate?
Well, typically, if you make the motion and second it, then we can have discussion. And usually, on something as important as this, we would postpone voting on to our next meeting. But in order to vote on the next meeting, we should have it formally on the.
Make a motion for adoption. Is that what we're saying? Was that a motion?
Are people familiar with the nature of the resolution?
Is the resolution circulating?
Have people seen the resolution? It's not we should read the resolution, probably.
Yes.
It is in today's package.
Okay, so it's there. And you are formally moving that we adopt the resolution as written in the package.
Yes.
Is there a second to that?
I second that.
Okay. So discussion on the motion.
I support divestment, especially divestment from fossil fuels, but just as an addendum to this, I think that there is an issue in sharing and paralleling the morality of divestment from fossil fuels and our understanding of divesting from apartheid in South Africa and slavery. And just in the sense that I think the arguments presented a lack of critical lens for race, but with that being said, that's just all.
And just for the record, I only mentioned that because that was a statement made in a Chronicle article. It's not something that's a part of the resolution or anything like that. It's not meant to necessarily be a fair
equivalency. When I read the resolution, I wasn't in there, so that's why I just say it in the.
Just a statement in reference to a past statement, basically. Right.
And I tend to agree with you, but I would note that Desmond Tutu made the comparison saying that actually climate change is as the principle of apartheid.
And where that might be the fact, I think that divestment from fossil fuels is very different than divestment from apartheid. Mm-hmm. And especially when we understand it to be affecting refugees, as it does say in the White Pages, and communities like Houston, New Orleans, and specific communities of color.
Assemblies pass the same thing, right? What kind of response do we get from the trustees? I mean, can they just say, okay, is that enough? Or how do you follow up? How do you check? Because right now, like, there's a lot of unknowns. Like, how much of the endowment is in this? And how are you going to do it? How are you going to prove you did it? How does that work?
This is a partial answer to your question, but I did read a study that showed that the announcement of divestment makes an impact.
Oh, sure.
Even if they don't follow through. Obviously, we would prefer that they did follow through. I think that they have no obligation to tell us what the investments are, so they would have to hold each other accountable, right? If they promise to divest, they could say, you know, we're going to do it on such and such timeline, we're going to do it in 5 years, or they could just say, yes, we'll do that, but then they would have to be the people to report back to us. So, of course, we do have a faculty, or two faculty trustees and a staff trustee, so we would hope that they would be honorable.
We have trustees, but there's the investment committee, which is not, I don't know what the lineup is there, so that's where the action is.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the process, specifically the way that they laid it out, is that if a resolution proceeds, whether it's if it's from all of the assemblies, it goes directly to the board, regardless, it goes to the president, but it can also just go directly to the board. And it's submitted to the board's executive and investment committees, the full board's notified, and then those committees and the president deliberate. They decide whether the criteria have been met, and then they make a recommendation to the full board. Obviously, that doesn't necessarily give us whether we're given the results of that. Other than a vote, there's a full vote that's required according to the process they laid out.
But you're familiar with the UCALIF. That's one of your lead examples, UCALIF. What was the press release from their trustees? Did they just say we're going to do it, or?
The article that announced the news was actually from their, not from the trustees, but from their financial officers.
Uh-huh.
So it was interesting. They're structured differently from us anyway, right? They come from a board of regents rather than the trustees. So I'm not exactly sure how that works, but they had an op-ed saying, you know, we're divesting from fossil fuels, but not for the reasons that you think. And it was a little bit of clickbait to get us to to read further to discover that it was all about the finances. So it's interesting that they led, you know, with the financial argument on the purpose.
Yeah, so one of my points, Charlie already raised, which is monitoring, and what compliance would look like. But I was thinking Gavin's point, there have been other divestment moves, and some of them have used some of the kinds of language we have here. Like, morally reprehensible. And the example you gave of advertising, that looks a lot like smoking.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a few examples like that would help bolster your case by making parallels. And the public stance part of it, I think you don't have to make the comparison with a bar diet to say that we're doing something like this, we're taking a public stance. I think there's apartheid, smoking, also fuels a kid, any other divestments, but you know, to think more broadly about the portfolio as taking a moral stance,
mm-hmm.
and that this has been done before, this
mm-hmm.
is not something new, that would be a good move to make.
Mm-hmm.
The compliance thing? No, I don't understand why we cannot look at the portfolio, which I think portfolio statements from telling me I don't want to know, but why isn't the portfolio open to inspection?
I was interested to hear from a colleague at Harvard that when the Harvard Faculty Senate considered divestment recently, the faculty was outraged to learn that they could not see their investment portfolio. So it's a thing in the private university sector not to make public your investments. That might be something to work on separately, but it's also clearly of interest to us as a community.
Some parts of it are very sensitive because they're private agreements or some kind of, and you set those aside. But when you're buying common stock and bonds and so forth, that's just a market. And I don't see any reason why we wouldn't be able to see those as well. And that would help with your monitoring. Because what it says now, when you say Cornell divest from all investments in coal, oil, and natural, that's not going to happen. Because so many companies have partial interests, and they're just, in some cases, very conglomerates. They have one part there and one part here. It's just not all investments, not going to happen. So, but monitoring the compliance, if you inspect the portfolio, we can say, but you still have shares of Exxon, you still have shares of whatever it might be. I think you should think about this. Because it's you're gonna get not absolute compliance from monitoring, but you can see whether you're doing anything about the spirit. And it is going to be a spirit. Did you change the portfolio at all? So I think you should look at it.
I suspect that that's a much bigger amount to find actually than the divestment is the monitoring. But it's okay. This is the kind of body that could go for that if we'd like. But I do just want to point out that these are the colleges and universities that have committed to full divestment, and there are criteria for full divestment, so and ways of accounting for that. So we don't have to reinvent the wheel if we do that, if there are precedents for full divestment.
My suggestion is we take a few more minutes for discussion now, but we not vote today following the normal procedures of some way. We will schedule a vote for our next meeting. And Charlie, is there something we can comment on online?
Yeah, so employee assembly here, Senate voting on the same thing. What's the story in the TPSA and then the SA? And also, I'm talking probably to most of the students, are there other groups out there who are outside of the assembly structure who have their own ideas and maybe they're at variance with what the assembly is saying?
I think the GPSA is working.
But is this something this thing? I mean, is there, are we trying to get the
we
same?
We have coordinated,
yeah,
yes.
Yeah, okay, okay.
Yes. Not you and me, but but representatives of each of the bodies.
Yep. Thanks very much for asking.
But are there, I've talked to two groups in my office, just informally, like in the fall, and I don't know whether they're connected with the undergrad and the grad assemblies, or it's a, are there separate groups out there who say this is not the way to do it? I mean, I just kind of understand the lay of the land on campus.
Yeah, I mean, are the people on the student assembly that are spearheading it are working really closely with Climate Justice Cornell. So, like, that for all our intents and purposes, like, that's what we know. But the student assembly is also unique where any individual can work with an SA member and sponsor a resolution. In fact, like, you don't even need to be an SA rep to sponsor a resolution at the SA, so people can do it at any time. But the one that has the most momentum is one that is in coordination between students and representatives and Climate Justice for Health, that I think mirrors this basically exactly.
And those same students have the right thing.
Yeah.
There's just been communication.
Yeah.
Because it's to be effective, it has to come from all five assemblies that represent the community. With that, if you don't mind, let's move on. We're only about 12 more minutes. We're not voting today. But is this something that we can post comments online to you if we want to have an online discussion?
Well, we're all set. We have it. It's all set in the Senate for people to post online. There is. I like seeing faculty, staff, and students comment side by side rather than. So I can. We can advertise that. It's already out there. I mean, you can already do that.
Was that not already posted?
Just snooze it.
On our website. So before the next meeting, if you want, post comments there, we can look and have a discussion. We'll have a further discussion and then take it to a vote.
I thought I was sharing.
I would like to move on. The next agenda item is an update for the particularly the CJC. And Logan was here, left, and I know he wanted to try to come back.
Yeah, it's just meeting with Martha. The update, I don't think anything happened.
Whoever's on the panel, you think it's okay.
Yeah. And I think it's a subject, but we forwarded a draft of the first half of the campus code. To Martha, moved it and forwarded it in our last meeting. And so I think, and I know Martha has received it, and I think, I don't know what, whether or not we're discussing, but I suspect it's about how we proceed from there. The next item of the business for the CJC is the procedural section for the campus code. And we've already done some work on that, not much, but some. It's going to be fully as difficult as we can in our business in the first part. That's it.
In terms of the timing, we obviously would like, as an assembly, to do something before we end in May, right?
Yeah. That's,
and we need to get community involved at some point as well.
Yeah, no, the CJC is fully aware of that. It's a we're learning as we go about how to coordinate our individual suggestions and recommendations and turn them into a text. But it is really difficult work.
Any questions or comments on that? No? All right. I thought we'd take more discussion. We don't have to discuss.
I guess I will say one. I think it is important to understand that there are, you know, the details, the violation, like the words on the page, but then there are like the big structural questions of the code that we've been tackling. And I think sometimes you want to find a balance in those meetings of what is the big structural question that we're doing with this and what are the details and how do they relate. And I think whatever the university assembly sees, whatever that is, that's going to be there, like, the committee itself is not always a unanimous committee. Like, we take votes, like, on some of the big structural ones, and we have disagreements about them. So whatever the UACs know that there is always a second side to some of the stuff that we put down, and that if you have questions about it, we probably also raise questions about those things. And those votes can happen here again, because ultimately the committee reports up to the grander UA. And so, you know, I'm not the chair. Logan's not here. I don't want to speak on behalf of her. And just when the UA members will see the code, like what we've done in this past semester, but when you do, I would highly, highly encourage like reaching out to like myself, Gavin, Richard, Logan, all of us on the committee to be like, what was the committee thinking at this period of time? Like, we met weekly Monday for like 2.5 hours all of last semester, and those meetings are burned into my brain because I remember it and they're long. But like, please reach out to us with questions, because you'll find a variety of opinions amongst all the committee members as well.
One of those big structural questions, one of the big ones, it involves fraternities and sororities, and that's moving on a different timeline. I mean, Martha issued a set of guidelines, given the depth of the recent one of the, I can't see it's a pledge, one of the meetings. New regulations for fraternities, parties and mixers, and but it highlights one of the problems in regulating, somehow enforcing community values for a big part of the university that has been monitored aside from the code. And that is a big issue. It's an important when we come back to the UA and to the community at large, that's going to be one of the central issues in the process.
Let me just suggest to the entire committee that the committee consider identifying what those big issues might be, letting the full UA know sooner rather than later what they are, while also continuing to work, so we don't get jammed up on April 28th with some too rushed discussion.
I could say, like, as it stands right now, the two that we've gone back and forth on a lot, this concept of a student code and what a student code looks like instead of a campus code, and how it might fit into a different type of system, and then the institutional location of the JA in the organizational chart. So there's the University Council's office proposed moving the independent JA's office to, under the Dean of Students in Student Campus Life, under the Vice President of Student Campus Life. Those two questions on themselves have numerous amounts of opinion at the committee. Mine is very strong. People can ask me about mine. I make mine very clear at the CJC. And other people disagree. And so I think those big structural questions are great to start thinking about now. Of course, we're going to like officially like craft those, what those questions are. We can send that to everyone. But as of right now, those are the two big ones I can start to identify. advice of people who want to have informal conversations outside these meetings, like, super happy to do that, just kind of get the perspective of everyone. And I would also encourage discussing any of these, like, you know, going to the JA's office, asking the JA, the associate JAs, like, what are their thoughts, because I think that's also a really helpful thing. Like, those are the people on the ground doing the work every day, getting their opinion, especially at this level, I think is super important.
In fact, we could kind of anticipate or plan some kind of brief presentation where we lay those things out to the UA, not making decisions, but sort of what the issues are on both sides, because they are complex, and they it's going to be hard to get. We know the community in the long run is going to react to them, but and they're going to have opinions in practice of what they are. But in advance of that practice, probably not so much. And so I think if we did have a presentation, maybe it was 20 minutes or so, 7 minutes or so for three major issues, that would be a very good thing.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's a great point. Take it up that one, you're meeting.
Yep.
Here, please, I don't want to step in. With that, we're a little ahead of time, but let's thank you all. Thank you, Adam. Thank you, Carolyn. Thank you, CKC.
This has been a production of Cornell University. On the web at cornell.edu.